Hello?
This is a collect call from
Life of a Lifer.
To accept this call, press 5 now.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Life of a Lifer, brought to you by Design Conviction. My name is Salty Candace. Today, we are talking with Ezekiel Calgary. Ezekiel has been convicted for second-degree murder and aggravated robbery. He was sentenced to 35 years. He is now 42 years old. In 2016, Zeke published a memoir through the University of Minnesota Press about growing up in a particularly violent period in South Minneapolis. He was also involved in creating the Stillwater Writers Collective, the only full-time writing program in the state at Stillwater Penitentiary, created and run solely by incarcerated people. Hello, Zeke. Thank you for joining us today. We are very excited to have you. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good. I'm honored and humbled to be with you. Thank you.
No problem. No problem. We appreciate you taking the time to give us a call today. Now, I understand that most of your work deals with the dimensions of power and place, the expression of the marginalized, and the psychological landscapes we all experience. Can you explain a bit more about that?
Sure. You know, there's a lot with those categories. There's a lot going on there. As far as just dealing with the dimensions of power and place, we understand right now, we can see, I think most folks can see, as far as like what's going on in the world, we understand we can look and you can see, you know, these figureheads in space sort of showing us what power can do, and we see, you know, what their actuality is in the world. But, you know, the incarcerated have always sort of understood that and have always sort of had to deal with that up close and personal. And, you know, I've always tried to, you know, make work, try to write poetry, try to write fiction and deal with things, even in my own personal, you know, nonfiction and memoir work, with dealing with the feelings and the psychology behind that kind of experience, right? I mean, experience of dealing with this sort of thing of being suppressed, being sort of pushed down and living as a marginalized person constantly. You know, I'm a long-term offender. You know, I was given 35 years in prison when I was a young man, you know, which is not a uncommon experience for a lot of people in America, right? And for a lot of people who probably don't necessarily listen to this, but the people whose families may listen to something like this. And so, when you're in this, like, there's no real escaping that experience. And so, really, there's nothing left to do except for to examine what those dimensions are, right? And it's like, how do you navigate through that? And how do you gain power through those sorts of things, right? And as far as, like, dealing with the place aspect of it, right? Like, I mean, we are our own community, right? And, you know, we create our own culture amidst it, right? And, you know, like there was one year, I think, they had the 100th anniversary of our penitentiary, and they wanted to do this big celebration. They start putting banners out, and they make this big, like, declaration, and all these, like, old incarcerators start coming forth, and they start having these celebrations, and they lock us all in, and we're looking around at each other like, this is something that we're celebrating, right? And so, like, there is, like, this huge chasm between what people sort of look at as, you know, it's sort of this acceptable, like, idea of what human beings can do with other human beings. And I think, like, you know, a lot of that is, and a lot of, like, what our creation of art is, this, the stealing back of what our humanity is, and the stealing back of what our power is amongst that is. Because there's only so much of it you can get back, because there's so much of it that you just really physically cannot replace, you know.
Right.
And there's sadness in that, and it hurts me to say that part. But the other part of it is, you know, that, you know, I feel there's a power in the fact that you can get some of it back, but the sadness is that so much of it you just can't, you know? And along those same lines, and that's what the expression of marginalized folks. I mean, we talk about those things, right? Like, I mean, you know, watching the ways people have always lived their lives, right? Watching the way, you know, these people in cultures around the world have made art, you know, in communities that have been marginalized. You know, that's the sort of thing that drives me. I mean, James Baldwin, you know, he wrote about the fire next time there's this, you know, flame and it's passed on, you know, right? And it's taken, you know, it's passed on or it's taken, right? Sometimes like a generation just has to take it from the previous generation, but it burns. It burns through the human struggle constantly, right? And these are things, and I think they're things not only that I write about, but they're also things that I just think that the incarcerated write about in general.
Now, would you be able to tell us more about the memoir that you published in the University of Minnesota Press?
Oh, sure. Well, in 2016, I published This Is Where I Am, which was my memoir, which was the culmination of, you know, many years of work, you know, to all, you know, that being a writer, it was 18 years of being incarcerated and 18 years of working towards a level of accomplishment where somebody recognizes that you were good enough to have all this work put together in one place and said, here, go ahead, right? It was, I was fortunate enough, I met some good people who had influenced me and said, hey, you know, you're good enough. You should chop this around. You should, you know, do some looking and stuff. And so what it is it's my memoir, but really what it is it's about growing up in South Minneapolis, right? I grew up in South Minneapolis, just several blocks from really where the George Floyd murder happened. I grew up on 35th and 12th Avenue, which is really a few blocks away. You know, that 5 bus line that runs along Chicago Avenue, it's the bus I took to school. It's the bus I took to my first jobs, right? You know, I remember being stuck up on 34th in Chicago when I was, you know, 16 years old. And it was about how growing up in this neighborhood, which was also the neighborhood my father grew up in, and then how so many of the kids from this generation then ended up in prison for really long times, right? And it was about how our portion of our city contributed to mass incarceration. And it's small little percentage because South Minneapolis is small, Minneapolis is small, but it was our period of time and it was our, you know, it was that sort of like this really rash, really violent period of time that gave enough, you know, it gave enough for the legislature to say, this is our way of using this as our excuse to now, you know, start what is, you know, this really, really violent sort of slow genocide of that is mass incarceration, right? You know, and it was like, it's not to say that we weren't wrong in some capacity too, but it was this, you know, sort of like this impetus for all the other things we've now seen in the long term. This idea that we can solve all our problems with incarceration. And so when I'm writing this book, really my idea is that like, it's about me and it's about my family. Because my family, you know, we like to believe we're a normal family, right? Right? We all like to believe that we're normal people, right? This idea, right? And I'm a white male, right? I grew up with white parents, right? I grew up in South Minneapolis, which is a pretty diverse community. We always believe that we're very fair and we have fair ideas, right? Everybody wants to believe they're super fair. That we're not like, you know, we're not prejudiced like the rest of these folks. But, and that, you know, that these things wouldn't happen to us. But the truth be told is too that like these are the same experiences that have happened to African Americans and to Latin Americans and to folks of color and to people for so many years. And it was like it happened and like, you know, our family had to look around and say, you know what? There's something happening here, right? And we all had to take a step back and we also had to look at each other and say, you know what? There's something really funky happening here too. That's beyond just us. That says, you know, maybe our sense of right and wrong isn't exactly as correct as we always believed it was too, right? And I think throughout the course of this book too was, it was a greater sense. It was a love story really about my neighborhood. It was a love story about my family, but then also about how families and that love, you know, like I always say, like programming doesn't rehabilitate human beings and prisons definitely don't rehabilitate human beings. And the only thing that really, really helps other human beings are each other, right? Like the only thing we can really just hold each other up in that sense too. And then, you know, and unless like you can maintain the empathy and compassion in another human being, it's nearly impossible to maintain somebody's sanity in these long-term situations. It's really, really hard. And it was, for me, it was, I had this mother and this father and this grandmother, this trifold shield that were willing to ride it out with me throughout the long process of it. And so I wanted this book to be about the fact that, the reasons we get through, are because of these parts, right? And that, like, there is no real magic formula except for the fact that, like, we all suffer through this. And then in the end, what happens is, life still injures those too, right? Like, nobody comes out unscathed, right? Because that's really the real, real dark, like, secret of life is that, like, you can work as hard as you want, but, like, there's still the fire nipping at your feet no matter what, But it was an honor, and what it ends up being the super blessing. Because here's what happens is that very rarely are people able to publish through a reputable publisher while they're still incarcerated. I mean, people publish through journals, people publish through, they self-publish, and people put things out, but it was launched, they went through it, it got a lot of good press, and, I was really fortunate it got backed, right? I got some backlash through the department a little bit. Some of them supported, some people didn't, but for the most part, it happened. But it was more important that it happened because it set a precedent, because then it also set up something so that our community had a little more, it had something, some thrust, And it was something else too, that it gave this credential to the rest of the community.
That is awesome. Very awesome. Very well put. Now, my next question then is, for those of us that don't know, can you tell us about the Stillwater Writers Collective? I understand that you're a part of making it happen. So if you could tell us how it was started, what it was about, and why is it important?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I from what I understand, you guys did a previous podcast with my colleague, Chris Cabrera. He and I, it's one of my oldest friends. He and I, before the book, before the Stillwater Writers Collective, he and I spent quite a bit of time just in communion talking about our visions for our own lives and what we wanted to do with ourselves, right? I mean, what we want to do with our lives. The thing is, he's a really good graphic artist. He had things he wanted to do as a writer, as an artist. I really wanted this book, and it was at a point when I was, really trying to get started on the book, at least get going with the book. I had other work that I wanted to do, and we were trying to figure out a way to be able to get the attention of the public, get the attention of the literary community, because for the most part, what it was is we had a whole bunch of talented people, but what we didn't have was anybody who knew who the hell anybody was. We were very invisible. Because that's what prison really does, is it suppresses people, right? It's just this whole, like, your voice gets suppressed. And so that was what the most important thing was. And so, a lot of it was creating strategies to say, now, how are we going to get the attention of folks, right? So me and Chris would sit in a room, and we're trying to figure out how best to exact our visions, right? And, I think with the greater emphasis on how then do we use our visions then to, I think in one sense, get us free or get us to a point like where, we can find a greater meaning in what it is that we're doing with these really massive bits, right? Because you're still in this really ugly sort of no man's land of incarceration, right? And there's been writing communities in our prison at that point, right? We had in the early 2000s, we had this poetry group that was incredible. We called the SPG, and we had all these local poets that came in, really reputable, and we do these little poetry slams, and it was really strong, and I really thought I was really young at the time, and I was in it, and it gave me a whole lot of validation, and I really thought that this was going to be, what catapulted me into the next however many years of my bid. And then it got axed with the next education shutdown or the next whatever, a budget cut or whatever it was, right? And then we had this really cool creative writing class with these really good professors, right? And we published a book and we did a really cool reading and we thought, wow, we really have a community and we're going to get together. So the thing was, the prison had writers. And the prison had artists. And we all knew each other, and we all collaborated, and we all wanted to do stuff together, but we couldn't get anything long term. And Chris's vision was, Chris wanted, and it was really brilliant in a sense, because what he wanted was a long term program, something that just didn't go away, so that people who were in long term situations would come into a facility and they'd see that it's there, they could get involved, they would just be involved in it long term. As they got in it, they got better, they would meet people. And then as younger people would come in, they'd be involved. It'd sort of be the cycle to when you'd build a writing community, right? And it was genius, right? And the things that I was looking at is what I've always believed in is that the things that add value are accomplishments and things and events, right? Because the events are these sort of shared moments that people always remember, right? You know, and the readings, group activities, things that something where you have this unified collective power and people go, okay, wow, right? And because people look back, because I always feel like when it's programming, they can take programming and, you know, it goes away. But those events, you know, you have these created memories. And accomplishments, publications, awards, stuff like that, those things never go away, right? Like, and I feel like when you allow people to build credentials, right, you allow people to build a writing life, a writing career from within prison. I think that has a, you know, it adds to a much greater empowerment and long-term, a much longer lasting impact, right? And so for me, who was trying to build a writing career, who wanted a writer's life, that was what was most important. And so as we were talking, I was trying to figure out how collaborative that could be, right? And that's where he starts drawing up this idea for the Stillwater Writers Collective, right? Which is an idea of, okay, what we'll do is we'll get sort of an active roster together of all the guys who work and whatever. If you can come up with classes, when classes come, we'll give you a roster of guys that'll take these classes, it'll work, they'll participate. You know, we'll have a few open slots for new people as they come in and whatever it is. And, you know, this is it, you know, and we were fortunate at the same time that this writing program, this Minnesota Prison Writing Workshop happened to start bringing classes in around a similar time as we were starting to grow. And it turned out to be this wonderful synergy, you know. So it ended up being a thing that, like, Chris got his long-term writing program, but at the same time what it did was, by having all these classes, what it did was it cultivated a culture where it developed a lot of really, really talented writers who won a lot of awards, who ended up getting all these publication credits, right? It ended up being something that, like, over the course of the last, say, 10 years, right, we end up with this really burgeoning, blossoming community of people with their own voices who have really, really, like, cool, eclectic, different things to say and different kind of directions and their own kind of, you know, thing happening too, you know, personalities going, you know. And it's interesting because then what happened was, as a result of it is, because of the way the transfer system works too, is as, say, the MPWW then expanded, was able to teach classes in different facilities, then collectives started, you know, blossoming. And as people transferred, we now have collectives in most of the facilities in the state now too, you know, at, you know, self-operated, prisoner operated, and which, you know, is wonderful, you know. And what it was is, so in Stillwater, what you had was this sort of self-run, who not only did they were able to take classes and they ran who took classes and were able to configure that, they would have this monthly reading, which had nothing to do with me. After I was long gone, they were able to, it was completely self-sufficient and did its own thing. It was, you know, incredible. And you bring these guests in, guest writers and poets and whatever, and they brought Jimmy Santiago Baca in. It was incredible. Really, we're always working just to get our people free, right? That is really what our goal is. Working on just trying to create, you know, broader event schedule, at least at our facility. We haven't had that here. It's been much tougher to be able to get, you know, a regular kind of event schedule where, mm-hmm. where we're able to bring people in from the outside. We're able to have a broader, like, bring guests in. I think what we want is just more outside participation. I think the idea is if the free world has more interaction, there's less fear, there's less, plus there's also less manipulation, right? Like there's less room for these folks to manipulate what the narrative is about our story, right? You know, because the whole point is like when you write and you create and, you know, this is what you're doing, you are really trying to take back hold of what the story is, right? This is your story, what it is. And so the more direct interaction you have with the world, the more control you have over your narrative, right? And over the narrative of whatever that interaction is. And so I think what we've been trying to do is just create more direct interaction, right? You know, and so more direct and honest interaction too, like, I mean, seriously. I mean, that has a lot to do with that. I mean, and we want more programming, right? But I mean, I am also somebody that believes very strongly that, I mean, more programming doesn't mean anything if you don't free people. Freedom is the great liberator. I'm sorry, but, you know,
yes.
I'm sorry. I mean, like, people, they hide behind just saying, oh, but we give them books and education. And I mean, let's give people their people back. And in some cases, I understand that this is not like a simple formula, but I also believe too that, like, you know, if we believe in the redeeming spirit, or we believe in any way, you know, the redemptive spirit, I mean, I think we have to start looking at different ways of being able to open up some of these things, because the problem is there's too many people. And even for folks that you feel like you have to keep in these places, you know, the problem is that you've overpopulated these places so that you can't even give the resources to the folks that really need them, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, I remember speaking a couple years ago. We put these programs on at a different facility, and they were really powerful. We brought the governor's entire staff in, right? I sat and ate lunch with the chief of staff, and I spoke in front of this group. And, you know, I've never had access to power like this before, and, you know, I'm obviously always very suspicious of these things because, you know, these folks have never specifically given me a spot at their table before. And I spoke in front of these people, and we would talk with these folks. And so as a result, I would have to, when we would organize these things in front of these big important folks, right, you'd sit in front of these people and, you know, you're not used to these people giving a spot at the table. And I would have to sit. And I spoke with wardens, and I remember sitting with the warden and asking him, because I had evidence, you know, from these old newspapers from the prison. I said, look at you, and he's bringing in, you know, he had played for, you know, the university here, and he's bringing in his old basketball team, right? And I remember looking at him, and I'm looking at all these, like, old banquets, and I'm thinking, I was like, oh, and I said, you know, how come we don't have these things? And he looked at me, and I'm looking at all these, and he explained to me, he said, hey, there was 400 people in the prison back then. He said, there's 1,500 now. And then he looked at this other prison. He said, there's 2,000 here now. There was 900 before. And then he went here and he said, there's 1,800 there now. There was 300, right? And so, like, what it says to me is, it says, when they over-incarcerated these spaces, they couldn't give those resources that everybody had before to the people who were supposed to be incarcerated. Right? Because you have so many people who aren't supposed to be incarcerated because you've decided that that was your answer for everything. And so I look at it like, as somebody who knew I would come to prison, as somebody who takes responsibility for what it is that I did, I would have come to prison for something. You're sitting here and you put all of these really short-term people and they eat off of the plate of these really long-term people. Let those folks go home. Let people go home and give these long-term guys who've been down too long, give them opportunities. Stop. You know what I mean? And, you know, I feel like a couple more years is not going to help anything. It's not going to help people's sanities, you know, so. It's really not.
Yeah, quite the contrary.
Yeah. And one of the things we've been working on too is trying to get, and we've been getting a good response. What we do is we work on getting, coordinating people in the community to write letters of support for lifers going up to the board, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unfortunately, in Minnesota in 2008, all lifers are without parole. Everybody who got a life sentence in the state of Minnesota got it without parole. But prior to that, all those that are coming up now are after 30. So So what we've been doing is we've been getting people in the community who support them to write letters of support for when they go to the board. And so far, we've gotten great response. Plenty of people have been getting their step downs and are moving towards release. And it's been a good thing. And we're getting great responses.
How awesome is that? That's really encouraging.
It feels really good. So,
would you say that art helps humanize and empower people who are incarcerated?
I say it can. I think if it gets recognized. I think the problem is, I think prison in general, by nature, is suppressive. I think art is something that is meant as expression. I think it's something that's meant to be, you know, this tool, right? It's a manifest, it's a piece of power, right? And I think it has to be in power, right? Like it has to be able to get out into the world, right? And I think that's a big thing about stuff that me and my colleagues were trying to do. I think it's a big thing about a lot of the stuff that, like, that in the last, say, 10 years that arts communities have been trying to help us out with is, you know, like, recognizing incarcerated writing, recognizing incarcerated art, because that's where the empowerment comes from. Because if you empower and you say, this is somebody that we recognize, this is an actual person who's creating this. This is an actual artist. This is an actual writer, rather than this just being, you know, an offender or an inmate or a prisoner or in just some way, like anything that is, negates your humanity in a sense too. So, like, I think, like, the idea is to humanize and empower, but without the actual humanizing and empowering factor of it, you have to incorporate the human beings and the power, right? And that comes with other human beings and power.
Now, in your opinion, what can we do as a society to change the general perception about people who are incarcerated?
Well, I mean, when you say that, we say as a society, as though, like, as a society, we are a collective that agrees on stuff, right? Like, I mean, and especially, like, when we look at our society now, that is, there's just so many damn factions, right? And I don't expect society as this whole organism to do anything to change general perception. But I would say that, you know, the artist community, free artist community, literary communities recognize your incarcerated artists, right? Help figure out ways, right? Recognize them. You know,
yep.
People who have family members, recognize your incarcerated family members, right? I know it's hard sometimes because sometimes, like, you know, we're hurt by each other, right? We hurt each other. So, like, I mean, I know that's a thing, right? You know, but then also on the other end, right, too, like, those of us who are incarcerated have to do something to change the general perception about people who are incarcerated as well, right? I have to have that conversation with the people that I mess with in here, too. This is, hold on, we have to give somebody a person that people don't have a choice but to respect. Because the problem is that, like, you get demeaned to a point where, like, you believe that the only version of yourself that you're giving to society is this version that they've told you you are for so many years, right? It's an ugly thing, right? And so, like, I can ask society to do something for me for years. I mean, like, at the very basic level, I can say, please have some decent housing for me when I get out. Can you please accept me and let me rent somewhere? Right? Like, that's it. It's like the most basic level. Hey, can I get some basic services out in the world? Right? Like, I want those things. That's a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as, like, being an incarcerated human being, how about you support? How about you support some legislation sometimes that eases up some of the things that lock things down? How about you go to your legislature and say, we want you to free our people once in a while. Why don't you push on these people to do something once? Because here's the thing. It's like you've given so much power to corrections. Of all people, you've given so much power to these people, and we never put any pressure on them whatsoever, right? You know, so I don't know. There are things I can ask society to change the general perception, but I can only really work on what we do on our end, right? And I try on our end to just be able to create a better person, to be able to bring to you guys, right? And to say, hey, so when you do run into us, it says, you know, like we always would say, let's bring the best and the brightest to folks. So when they come, they go, okay, at least I know, because there's plenty of people we could bring to you guys that you would say, I wish you hadn't, right? And in that case, then, you know, then I don't know if we're winning these battles. I don't know if we're winning popular opinion or what, but those folks need help too, right? And then that doesn't change anything, right? But in the broader sense too, that doesn't change the fact that like people who are incarcerated probably because of something that is much broader, much more systematic and much uglier, right? And we need to attack those things in the same sense. And I would like to also sort of say, because we are in this particular period of time, which, you know, this particular period of time isn't any different than any of these other particular periods of time, but I would like to, just because now we have, you know, a lot of things we are talking about, the police, and we are talking about dealing with things systematically, that incarceration is the end of that same pipeline. And it is another level, and it is probably a much more violent extension of that same violence, right? It is a much more violent mm-hmm. of that same brutality. And it is, you know, it is much more brutal to put a human being away for many, many years and, you know, snuff out, you know, their hope and snuff out, like, you know, their dreams and their, you know, like, take fathers out of families, right? You know what I mean? And that, like, I think somehow, like, if we don't attach that thinking to whatever it is that we are pushing on right now, right, like, we're not going to be able to extend that thought, right? And so I think, like, right now is a good time to be able to connect those things right now. And it's sad, like, those are heavy thoughts and they're heavy things to have to connect, but, you know, as an incarcerated human being, when you ask me about how we connect society and how we connect society to us, to you, you know, this is where we go. When people's voices are loud and then they're screaming now, these are what we're screaming for.
Awesome. Very well put.
All right.
Well, Zeke, we just want to thank you for joining us today and giving us a very powerful interview and sharing your experiences with us. And we appreciate all that you've done and everything that you've been able to accomplish, and we want to wish you the best of luck in all your future endeavors. And we just hope that, you know, we're able to share your story a little bit, give you a little bit of something to go on so that you yourself feel empowered and that you are heard, and that some organizations like ourselves, we're there for you guys.
All right. I appreciate it. Thank you much. And send my best to your founder.
I will.
He's doing good work. I appreciate that much. All right.
I definitely will.